Recording in Los Gatos, California on March 14th, 2016. This is Geek Speak, episode 11 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. Hey, I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm the host and producer of Geek Speak, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a music geek.
Oh, you told me to edit
geek,
this.
And teacher, traveler, and music geek. Dude, it even says...
So, just because nobody but you and I knows what just happened, you wrote a big note that said, Ben, edit the script and update your thing. And I got halfway through editing it. And
which means you made it worse, because it says, a music and video geek, teacher, traveler, and music geek.
Oh, yeah, that's me. I really like music.
It doesn't matter. We know who you are. It's good to hear you back on the show. It's been a little while.
What's up? It's good to be back on the show.
Yeah. While we were gone, we had a discussion. I had a discussion with Miles all about FBI and Apple fighting. Mm-hmm. And then last week we talked. Bonnie and I chatted a little bit more about an update on it. So I don't feel like we can go deeply in it, but I know that you'd want to say a few things if you could.
I don't have anything to add that you and Miles and you and Bonnie haven't already covered, but. John Oliver did do a really great segment on the Apple, on the FBI and Apple. And he kind of went into it. His segments are really good.
Oh, like, yeah.
They're well researched and everything and very funny. So,
and you don't have to have HBO to actually see it because they put a lot of the stuff on YouTube. So there's a link to a YouTube video of him.
Yes,
doing
indeed.
Right?
Cool. Up on the site. So if you are not tired of hearing us talk about it,
or want to hear somebody else do it.
I was just going to say too bad because we're not going to talk about it anymore. Okay. But if you want to hear more, John Oliver is a wonderful second to Geek Speak.
All right. I'll be watching right after the show because I haven't actually seen it. All right. Well, what else is intriguing you lately? I definitely – something's like sticking right out in my face right now. You have a political statement on your laptop. And
oh, I do?
You don't seem to be a political person at all.
I have a political statement.
You're recommending two names for the 2016 presidential election.
There's a bumper sticker on my laptop. It says...
Picard and Riker.
2016.
Now, Picard and Riker, of course, are the captain and the
first officer
of the
Enterprise. NCC 1701-D.
That's right. The most
Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Next Generation, your favorite series of them, I think.
No, DS9 is.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but we shouldn't have this conversation now because it'll be half the show.
To boldly sit where no one has sat before.
Yeah, like it's wonderful. Sometimes you just got to look at what's around you.
You really like Deep Space Nine more than Next Generation.
I really do.
There's few things I disagree with you.
It's a little less episode. Have you seen DS9 seasons 4 through 7?
I guess I should watch them. I mean, I watched them not... I watched Next Generation like every week. I've watched every single episode at least once.
If you'll put aside the time...
Space Nine, maybe I should do that.
If you'll put aside the time, I will drive all the way over the hill...
Just to watch it with me?
Just to watch it with you every episode.
We could Skype watch it together.
And the only reason I'm making that request or recommendation is that I know that you won't, and that's fine.
Oh, now I'm going to.
It's a challenge.
And every time I do it, I'm going to pour 2 cups of tea, and one won't be drinking. Okay, why Picard
Please,
and Riker?
Earl
then?
Grey
because
tea.
If you like Deep Space Nine, wouldn't you want to go with the people? I don't know.
Oh yeah, I couldn't find also what Sisko and Kira. Really. But here's why. Here's why I put this. And this is a bumper sticker. This is a sticker, a joke that's been going for years and years and years. I think they
every
had a
presidential election
back in
sure.
2008, 2004. They just remake it and keep selling them. The reason that I bought it this year is because I recently started a job at Facebook, and I wanted to find a way of figuring out who the Star Trek fans were around me.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it's a great conversation topic. It means I'm basically going to be friends with them.
And have they found you?
Nobody.
Nobody knows what it is?
Nobody has said, hey, nice bumper. Like, nobody said anything. And... that either means that nobody who likes Star Trek works at Facebook, except for one guy who has a United Federation of Planets flag hanging above his desk. Aside from that guy, either nobody works at Facebook who likes Star Trek, or people are just a little more discreet about it. So I think I'm taking, I don't know.
You should add a little balloon that says, talk to me about, and points it down to it.
Yeah.
I've been, so you and I are friends on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You are having lots and lots of more friends on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Well,
what's
because
going on there, man?
So that's not true. Well, first of all, my friends at Facebook, I'm becoming friends with them on Facebook, not just the like
right.
work
whole
system, but
met. Yeah.
But also, it's strange. I get a lot of friend requests all of a sudden,
mm-hmm.
like people who I have no friends in common with, random people from random countries, this one, other
right.
countries,
my
friend.
I got a Facebook question for you.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say I post a lot of the stuff I post on Facebook. I love this, by the way, that I'm doing this because people do this to me all the time about Netflix and I never know how to answer it necessarily. But anyway, when I post stuff on Facebook, almost always I'm posting it as public. Not my friends can see it, but just public.
Because you choose to.
Because I choose to.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I choose to do that is that most of the time, the stuff I put on the internet, I consider public. I don't try to make a distinction unless I really am trying to communicate privately. So,
yeah. I mean,
a video
do
of my
run
kids,
a radio show.
Right.
So.
A video of my kids' recital from school, I'm not going to do public. I'm going to do friends and family
sure.
groups. Right. I kind of manage that because why do that publicly? Who cares? Except for the friends and family. So when I do that, I know people can see it. When somebody's made a friend request to me and I never resolve it, I don't decline it and I don't approve it or anything, are they now following me on Facebook? Will they see my public stuff in their feed? Or do I have to do something to make them follow me? Or is it two different things? Or do you not know? All those things are fine.
I'm sure I know somebody who knows the answer to that.
Oh, good.
Definitively.
Will you find out? Because I've actually been trying. Well, we could try it after the show.
I actually don't know anyone on that specific team, but I could poke around.
So specifically, you can follow people on Facebook and you can also befriend people on Facebook. And that's a choice you can make.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just have always assumed that if someone tries to friend me and I don't do anything, they're technically following me. But I really don't know. I'd love to convert them to follows. Because the truth is...
All of that stuff is I've learned... So much. I already thought it was ridiculously complex. It's so much more complex than I thought it was, right?
Yeah, yeah,
and
sure.
So I think I don't know. So the short answer is I have no idea.
Could you do you care? Because I'd love to know. So
well,
I don't
yeah,
know how
yeah,
to know.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. We can do an experiment.
All right. Well, see, doing an experiment would be really difficult because you have to find somebody that wanted to experiment with you who is not friends with you. You and I could befriend each other.
I could probably find a test account. No, anyway.
Okay, well, if you need a Netflix flavor in return, just let
me
know.
I'll find somebody to ask that question to.
All right. Maybe I'll put you in a really fun test for Netflix.
Ooh, that'd be fun.
What do you watch? Do you watch on TV?
Can you do that? Can you just whitelist individual accounts?
Sure.
Does anyone ask questions?
No. Freedom of responsibility.
Yeah, yeah, good.
I mean, you know, I do it respectfully and all that.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You want to talk about pins?
Pins? Like pins and needles?
Personal identification number.
Okay, so we have talked about passwords a lot on this show.
Sure.
We haven't really talked about pins as much. And pins are the number when you go to withdraw money from your bank account and it says enter your pin and you go boop, 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 boop or whatever it is. And then you can withdraw $300 or whatever, right? That number, that is effectively a password
sure.
to your bank account, right?
A pretty short password normally, right? Because they're like four digits for an ATM.
Four digits.
Not very
so
good.
So that's 10,000 possible combinations. You think 10,000, that's a lot. But when you're talking about alphanumeric passwords, that's a heck of a lot more than that, right?
I would assume like at an ATM machine, if you went up there and you put in the pin like 7 or 8 times wrong, the card
would be like,
eaten,
you know
right?
what? Just stop.
So that's why it kind of works.
It kind of works, yeah. right? The problem is that people are not very good at pins. Just like people are not very good at passwords, people are not very good at choosing good pin numbers. So,
can I be a pedant for a second?
Yes.
You said pin numbers.
Personal identification numbers. It's like ATM machines.
Oh, I said the same thing.
Automatic color
machines.
Okay. do you want to just guess what's the number one pin in the world?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, man, that's my pin.
Oh, no. Okay, I've got a whole bunch of facts about this. Basically, somebody took a bunch of compromised databases of pins, right?
That right.
compromises over the course of, I don't know, some number of years. That's where all this data is sourced from. He didn't go and like hack into a bank or something. But yeah, the most popular pin code is 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm going to tell you what percentage that
oh,
is.
Can
in
I
a second.
Can I guess?
In a second.
Okay, good.
First, I want to tell you a couple other numbers. If you want a 50% chance of guessing someone's pin, out of 10,000 possibilities, you just have to guess 426 codes. If you guess the right 426 codes, the most popular 426 codes, that makes up half of the PIN numbers.
Okay.
Which is like...
We want to count half, it's 456. That's not 50%, but I get what you're saying. So 50% is within 400 and something. So those are the pins
right.
to check.
So you guess... Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you want to guess one-third of all codes, you can guess that by trying the top 61 combinations.
Oh, wait, the top 61 pins are 30% of all pins being
33%.
Used. Wow.
That's a lot.
I'm assuming that includes all the single-digit repeated, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Just the all the highest ones. All right. How about 20%? If you guess the top five, the most popular five pins.
Oh, my gosh.
You have a 20% chance of getting into their account. So you said, you know, like the ATM will eat your card, let's say, after seven tries. If you try the top five ones,
yeah.
you're going to get into 20%, one in five. Of the accounts.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
The most popular PIN code is 1234. That is
Can I guess?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess that is a... Let's see. The top 20%
is the first six.
Wow. So it's like 10%?
Yeah.
1234 is 10% of pins?
Yes. Means is... If this is a representative sample, which it probably mostly is, 10%, 10.7%, almost 11% of people, their PIN is 1234.
Okay.
So that's depressing, but not actually all that surprising.
So what you're saying is next time you're at a family reunion kind of thing, you look around the room, just group 10 people out, one of them is going to have 1234 as their PIN. So you could say...
Well, it's a family reunion, maybe more than
one. But you could definitely do a stage thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
And go, by the way, someone in this room has a PIN of 1234.
And then Grandpa Joe will be like, how'd you guess?
Now, I'm assuming that banks right now will not allow a 1234. But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, because this is data over time.
This is data, and it's also from multiple sources. So who knows? That's crazy.
If your PIN is 1234, please change it.
Please, please, please change it. All right. So a couple other interesting things. Years.
Yes.
Years of birth. So 1967, 1955, 1937, 1992. Those are all very, very high probability. So
don't do that.
Actually, in fact, every single combination of 19 something something can be found in the top fifth of the data set.
That's amazingly cool.
So, yeah, that's a big one.
I mean, really, if you have some time to guess, you're going to do it pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. All right, I got a couple more for you. There's a really great chart here. I'm going to show it to you, and you can maybe try and describe it.
It's a beautiful. It's a flame chart image. It's a large 600 by 600 pixel red and orange flame chart.
A flame chart is just basically it's all red, but then some things are a little bit more yellow.
More bright.
More bright.
And the more bright they are represents the more usage they have, I'm assuming. Are these all pins?
Yeah, these are all pins. Cool. So There's a line from the bottom left to top right, and then there's also a line that just goes straight vertically.
Yeah,
so I'm gonna tell you what those things are. So first of all, there's a grid pattern that you can kind of see in the plot. It's a kind of a subtle one, but that actually represents that people don't like to choose numbers that are far away from each other, that are consecutive. So, for example, someone is much less likely to have the numbers 4 and 8.
Imagine a keypad right now. You see that those aren't close to each other. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to do like 1, 2,
or
4, 5,
or 6, 7.
Right.
Yeah. So that's one.
So they correlate closer together, sure.
Yeah, there's the horizontal dot is every 11th dot corresponds to 1111, 2222,
right, sure,
3333, all of those, right? Or 2244, 2255, etc. It's just so sad talking about this. The bright line that's going vertical in this flame chart represents all of the 19-something-something numbers,
right?
1925, 1926, 1927, 1928.
Any date, basically, yeah.
Any date that is in the 1900s.
Right.
if you're in the 1800s, well, you're really, really old.
And in the aughts, I mean, we've got 16-year-olds. They've got bank accounts, right? It's 2006. They could have been born in 2000.
I guess so. We're going to start seeing that in the data, yeah. There's also a strong bias towards the lower left quadrant of this flame chart, which represents all the people who like to start their PIN numbers with zeros and ones.
Oh.
And then there are also these little bright specks that are kind of sprinkled all throughout this flame chart, and those represent things like 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
yeah, yeah,
5,
sure.
6, 7, 8.
Little runs of numbers.
Yeah, and then there's also 2, 4, 6, 8, which is a jump of 2, right?
Sure. Well, see, now I'm trying to think. I recall with passwords, one of the general ideas is don't try to be smart with your password.
Uh-huh.
Get it random.
Yeah.
But so in this situation, what do you do to pick a good PIN?
You don't do what you feel like doing.
You know what happened to me recently?
Like passwords like 6969 and 6666 and 1234, they're not clever. They're like you're choosing them because they're not random-ish.
Right. So what you really should do is roll some 10-sided die.
Right.
Just, whatever
four
those
times.
Numbers are, just use them.
And then that's your
And
pin.
What if you happen to get 1234? Then you're like, no, it was really random. I did it right and it was random.
That would be
fantastic.
Yeah.
Then you know something's wrong with your temporal awareness. Mm-hmm. Okay. So seriously, how do you get a good PIN? Does it matter that much? I mean, if
it does, because this is okay. So we have talked about two factor authentication
absolutely.
In the past. The idea that you have think of it as multiple doors, right? Multiple things that are trying to keep the baddies out, right? So you've got the password, you've got the thing that you have, like the YubiKey or the thing on your phone that generates a pseudo random-ish number.
Even your cell phone number, they might send you a text and you have to click on something. That's one way to confirm
right,
it.
Sure. Right, absolutely. Banks have two-factor authentication and everything. With PIN numbers, there's really not an option for that, right? And so you can't really go with a security measure like that. You just have to choose a good PIN. Now, you are going to be limited that the attacker, the person who's trying to guess your PIN, is probably going to be limited by the amount of money that they can draw out, right?
Sure.
For example, like if I go to the ATM, even if I am me, I can only withdraw $300 or something dollars.
My bank changed it to $600, but yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that makes it a little bit safer.
Yeah.
To be clear, the PIN is the second factor authentication, right? The first factor is the ATM card. You've got
That is true.
Card, and then you have to have a
unless you create a spoofed one, which is definitely possible.
Absolutely. And your card number does get out, right? It is a credit card number as well. And so it does get out in the wild and can be guessed.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that's kind of frustrating about credit cards.
They're
not actually that random.
But it is harder to guess a credit card number, even though it's not as hard as it should be, and it's not as hard as you think it is, because some of the numbers are not random. Like the first couple numbers are an identifier.
Represent the card.
They represent what kind of card it is, right?
Sure.
But it is more random than a four-digit PIN. So really, the four-digit PIN is your best chance, right?
Yeah.
You will likely be protected by your bank. Your bank is going to step in and say, oh, yeah, that was definitely a fraudulent transaction. We're going to give you the money back. But it's still much better to just not be in the situation in the first place. So it means don't have your PIN be one of the top numbers, right? If it's a number that's meaningful to more than just you, then it is a really bad password. If it's a number that is meaningful to you, it's probably still not a great password. Like, for example, if you do someone's birth date or if you do your birth date, those are numbers that can be guessed, right? But there's one other thing that I think is worth kind of repeating, even though it's not often talked about at security conferences, because they're really talking about how do you really secure something if someone is trying to launch an attack against you. In most situations, except for high-profile people like you and me, I mean, we run this podcast, people are not going to be trying to attack you, the person, the listener, right? People are going to try and attack 10,000 people all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And if you attack 10,000 people all at once, who are you going to go for? You're going to go for the easiest targets.
Right, right. The lowest bar is the one that's going to get attacked, right? So if you have the PIN 1234, when they go through a whole bunch of people, they're going to try all these PINs, they're going to try it on yours, and
Absolutely.
You're going to get nailed. And that's why you need to have something kind of more rare.
Yeah, and in fact, if you have a very rare PIN,
it's unlikely.
it's actually probably safer than it would be statistically likely, right?
So you should change your PIN to make it really rare, but everyone else shouldn't.
Exactly, exactly.
Hey, cool. Anything else on this one?
Yes, I've got just a couple more things. I wanna play a game. First, I want to tell you a couple more quick facts, and I want to play a game. I think you'll do well at this game. So first of all, it goes through some interesting observations, and I'm not going to read all of them. But for example, for five-digit passwords, users appear to have even less imagination in selecting their codes.
Oh, interesting.
22.8%, 23% select 12345 sure. as the password, right? In position for 10-digit passwords, in position number 17, people choose 314159265 4, which
that's
are
today's date. It's high.
And we actually have another story about that coming up later in the episode.
Sure.
But first, I just want to play a brief game with you. Because the data
set... By the way, pi is also the speed limit on my property.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 3.14 miles per hour, not 31.
No.
Or 314. Okay. I already gave away the answer to question number one, which is with 5 digits, what's the top password?
Right. 1 through 5. All right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. With 6 digits, what's the top password?
I'll go with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Ding, ding, ding. You're right. What about 7?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
What about 8?
I'm going to go the same.
Okay. Same with 9. Same with 10.
I'm really? It's going to go to 0?
Yeah.
Okay.
You just take your finger and all the way around. And actually, the second highest, that's 20% of people choose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0. And then the next... most popular is 2.3%, which choose 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then it goes 0, 9, 8, 7, 6. So like, if you are one of those people, and we know that over 10% of our listeners are, change your PIN. Seriously. Because you never want to be the lowest hanging fruit.
Right.
If you're not the lowest hanging fruit, you know, you've done your due diligence. It's always better to be safer. That's like the get yourself 90% of the way there, right?
And you really can do a search for random number generator and get the stuff that's easy to get online.
Definitely.
You could also write it yourself. It's a pretty fun little script to write.
Yeah. Math.random, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks. Hey, in a minute, we're going to talk about Ben's exploration of being a software developer for free. The open source, non-paid back Google Chrome extension part of Ben's world.
Oh, yeah.
Stick with us, won't you? You're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio KSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Mr. Ben Jaffe. In a second, we're going to talk about Ben's Chrome extension. But first, I wanted to do another kind of follow-up from last week. Last week, I talked about how to make sure your battery lasts a lot longer. I don't mean the actual charge duration, but the duration of the usefulness of your battery. Over time, batteries get less and less effective mm-hmm. at charging and discharging. And the recommendation is just try to keep it charged as much as possible. Lithium-ion mm-hmm. batteries should always just be trickle charged. Plug them in when you're in the car, plug them in at home as much as you can. The phone's battery will last longer for its life. Another thing people do all the time to conserve how much battery the phone is actually using is they kill applications. And in iOS, you can actually double-click the home button, and you can take it'll show you all the apps that are running. You can take one and just throw them up in the air.
Swipe them away with your finger. You can do that on Android, too. And they press the whatever key, something.
Something.
The app switcher thing, and you can do the same thing.
The important thing is this doesn't do anything. This is not effective at helping your battery conservation at all.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so for example, you think, well, the background
app...
That's
not intuitive.
Yeah, the app that's in the background could be using my my location information, right?
Right.
Like a mapping application. Right. Might use location information.
Or like Gmail. I mean, Gmail's always running and waiting for emails to come in, and when they do come in, then it pops up a thing.
So you destroy it, you'd kill the app, and then it doesn't do that. Except that, no, it does do that.
Mm-hmm.
What's
mm-hmm.
going on in the operating system is it goes, oh, they have this app that wants to know about location information, and they told it they can have location information all the time. So even if the app isn't running, we'll run them the app and give the location information.
So you're saying... Gmail then is not always running and waiting for the emails. Gmail has told the operating system of my phone, hey, when you get this message from this server,
a push notification, yeah,
then run this code and it'll pop up a notification or something like that.
Yeah, there are some differences depending on how the app is implemented, but yeah, the geolocation stuff, you basically say, I want to subscribe to this, and the OS, if you're not running, will launch you and pass the data to you.
Yeah.
So it's not effective.
So it'll say, hey, the phone just moved.
If you want to conserve energy, you have to go into settings and actually go to the energy area, and then you can turn features off. You can also put your phone in iOS, at least. You can put it in iOS 9. You can put it in like a conservative energy mode under settings, energy,
or power. There's this feeling that like when you bring up the app switcher, that's all the apps that are running, right?
Yeah, that's not really the case.
Right. So they're not actually running. They're there because you recently launched them, and they're running, we'll put that in air quotes, but really they've just been recently interacted with, and they're there for your convenience to pull them back up.
Right. So the quote is actually from Tim Cook was emailed this question. Tim Cook is the CEO of Apple. And Apple support documents have indicated generally there's no need to force quit an application to close unless it's unresponsive. That's right. And actually, that is the one reason when I'll do it. If I launch an app and it doesn't seem to do anything, I will kill
right.
it.
Yeah.
Sometimes that doesn't even work. You launch it again, it will still be frozen. So you have to reboot your phone.
Yeah, but, that's not good.
Yeah.
That's good to know. I mean, that's... Yeah, it's interesting. It's one of those things that, like, as software developers, you and I kind of intuitively understand, but we see people quitting apps all the time
yeah.
and everything. And then there are the applications which will automatically quit your apps for you, and or you can run the app and it'll automatically quit the apps. Like, there are all these things that are solving a problem that actually doesn't exist because it's implemented solved at a very low level by the operating system.
Yeah. So, and to be really clear, the apps for a second do run when they put in the background. They mm-hmm. do run to close out some events. But if the app keeps running and using a lot of resources in that space, the operating system will kill it.
Right.
So it's as an app developer, you have to be careful about not running the background. There are some differences, though. Location information, there's a few things like that.
Right.
And so that's where the conservation can actually happen. Okay, Ben, we just talked a little bit about what I do, iOS development. But you have this sideline project you've been doing for a long time, which is making extensions to the Google Chrome.
Chrome extensions. Yeah. Don't say it's what I do, because, oh, God.
Well, you've been doing it for a long time.
I have been, yeah. No, it's true. So actually, I years and years ago, I was using OkCupid to look for people. And
OkCupid is a dating service.
It's a dating
website
site.
Where
mm-hmm.
you can put in a profile about different answers about who you are, what you like. I like to walk in the woods, blah, blah.
Yeah, you answer a bunch of questions.
Other people do too. And then you get a match percentage of other people that are in your area or where you're going. And you can kind of see how likely it is that you might be in a good relationship with them.
Absolutely. Or a good friendship.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I kind of... It bothered me that OkCupid collected all of this information about me and all of this information about anyone I was talking to, all this information about all of their users. And the only thing they were really surfacing in an easy-to-use way was a percentage.
The average percentage match of
yeah,
the
percentage match, and put, quote, percentage match. So that's in air quotes, because
well,
knows what that means.
So this seems to me, just to be devil's advocate, this seems uh-huh. relatively useful in the sense that if you're looking through, I don't know, 100 people that are in your area that are single that have the same gender preferences as you, or reverse gender preference, whatever,
right.
likes you, and you like them because their gender preferences match, whatever, then the percentages is a pretty good way to start, because
absolutely.
You know, 90% is better than 20%.
But
right?
what about when you click on their profile and then you get more information? No. You just get, I mean, you get everything they wrote about themselves. But there's other information which is contributing to this percent, and this percent is actually pretty good at determining whether I'll like someone or not.
Oh, but these...
Why not surface that data in a better way?
And the averaging of it is hiding things that might be more important to you than other things.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they say, I love walking in the woods, but you said you didn't love walking in the woods, that's not a stopper. But I smoke 4 packs a day... I don't
that's
smoke at all.
That's
a stopper.
That's
still going to be a percentage match, right?
Yeah. So the plugin is called OkCupid for the non-mainstream user. Don't go
this
in.
This is the thing you made.
Yeah, this thing I made. It has, oh my gosh, I haven't looked at this for a while. It has 12,800 users. Holy moly.
Okay, so be clear.
So
Ben goes, there's something that could be better here. He writes something. He makes it an open
source
project.
I wrote it for myself.
For
I wrote it really poorly too.
And then I remember when you first made it, you sent me a thing, and I had to make an OkCupid page to actually to use it. And then
it had 2 users, and me.
And then I stopped using it because I never log in.
Yeah.
But there was 12,000 people using it.
Yeah, almost 13,000.
Does OkCupid have a relationship with you? Are you doing this for them? Do they know?
Not really, except that they published. They were using localstorage.clear instead of whatever localstorage.remove, and it was wiping away all of the data that I was storing to make the plugin work. So I politely tagged one of their engineers in a GitHub issue and said, can you fix this error in your code, please?
And they did change that.
They did. They changed it in like a couple hours. But that's the only relationship I've had with this company. Otherwise, it's been a completely separate side project, and it just happens to work out. They haven't done anything active to block me, but whenever they launch user interface updates, just like cosmetic updates to their website, my plugin breaks because that's what it's hooking onto.
So your plugin is inspecting the web page and then doing stuff based off the web page you get, kind of because you can kind of dissect what the page is. It's like a librarian, instead of having an index for a book, opening up a book and looking through it to figure out where it's going to go. That's not a good analogy.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a good analogy for non-programmers.
It's a little tricky. It's instead of looking at the thing itself, the data itself, you're looking at an artifact of the data. You're looking at something that was created from the data, and then you have to go through and like find, okay, where can I pull out the data from this thing that's been created from the thing that I actually want? I actually want the data.
So when they change the web page, when they make the look different, they change it slightly.
Yeah, they change
all of a sudden
the
way you're actually inspecting it stops working.
Right. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because I don't want to work on this plugin anymore. This plugin is it's awesome. I'm really happy that it has almost 13,000 people, and that presumably a good portion of those people are actually finding good getting use out of it. Right.
But is this because you're not using it anymore?
4.5 stars. It's not because I'm not using it anymore. But that's not the reason I don't want to work on it anymore. The reason I don't want to work on it is because I have a full time job. I do 2 podcasts. Like I've got all these other side projects. I do music, and
you also have a partner.
I have a partner. It's just something that I don't have the cycles for anymore. And it's really sad to say that, because I do feel strongly that this is providing a positive benefit to 12,000 people.
Okay, so one of those 12,000 people is probably a developer. Why don't you just say to everybody, hey, I got to let this go and give it over to somebody else. Then somebody else's problem, and they'll hopefully make it even better maybe.
All right, so a couple things about that. First of all, a couple people actually have stepped forward and said like, hey, I want to take this over from you. There is a difference between saying, hey, I want to do this side software project, and actually like following through, and like 3 months later you're still working on it. That there's definitely it's hard to say you want to do something like that and then actually follow through, because
it's
a time
that
commitment.
That person might get a job, might start a couple podcasts, might travel, might have a partner, and all of a sudden they drop it too.
Exactly. But
wait a second, that's not any worse than what's going on right now.
Exactly.
Okay.
But there's another reason.
What's the other reason?
The other reason is that if someone took over the Chrome extension, I would effectively be giving them 12,800 users. Now, it's not...
What do you mean giving them that?
Right. Yeah. See, so this is... It's a little hard to explain. It sounds like, oh, it's like you've collected 12,000 people and you don't want to give it up because you've earned it and it's yours. That's not at all what I mean. The problem is that Chrome extensions can do a lot of harm. So in order for my Chrome extension to work, it needs certain permissions.
So let me describe a little bit. If you're using the Chrome browser, Google actually has a whole store where you can load extra little extensions. Mm-hmm. And they do really cool things. One of them actually is like the extension Hangouts, which is something Google provides. So these are intentionally designed things that modify the browser. They're very common in the enterprise area where you get special editions. I use one called 1Password, which ties into my password management system. It automatically fills out forms. At the office, we have things that kind of modify the calendar to show you, even though you're in a calendar, it shows you the map of the building where the calendar is. So there's really detailed, intricate things that can happen because they have the power of the browser somehow. What do you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, what
do the permissions that this extension currently asks for is, the extension says, I need to be able to do the following. Display notifications. Seems innocuous enough. And read and change your data on all OkCupid sites.
Okay.
So a little less innocuous.
It's only specific to OkCupid, which is better than global. But basically that means that this Chrome extension could steal the username and passwords from OkCupid.
If I became nefarious,
you could do devious things.
Or if I gave it to someone who I don't know all that well, seemed like they have good intentions, but actually was nefarious, they could do a lot of harm too.
Yeah.
And
we're talking about some sensitive data on OkCupid.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's a lot of data. You can definitely trace people back to who they are if you really wanted to. I don't have any interest in doing that, but and this actually raises a larger concern about Chrome extensions in general. In fact, there was recently an article about how a Google Chrome extension was found to be stealing Bitcoins from users.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, that's not good. So Bitcoin is a decentralized cryptocurrency. We're not going to get into what that
means.
But basically,
it a lot on the show, sure.
It's like I could pay Lyle using dollars by just I mean, pulling out my wallet right now, I could pay you via PayPal. I could also pay you via Bitcoin.
And Bitcoin's really, I mean, the wallet that holds them is really just a big number. So if you know that big number, you can use that to give it away.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's also, if I try to pay you, a Chrome extension could just change the hash and I wouldn't know because I'm a human. I can't read hashes very well.
Right.
Now all of a sudden, I think I'm sending money to you, but just right under my nose, the Chrome extension said, actually, I'm replacing that with my hash. And because Bitcoin can't be tracked,
can't be reversed, really. Yeah, once it's happened, it's happened. It's like cash.
Yeah, once I hit send and I try to send money to you, it goes to some person somewhere.
So a Chrome extension is stealing these things by just basically looking for hashes that were Bitcoin and always changing it to their own wallets.
Mm-hmm,
a really clever little hack. I'm assuming that the Chrome extension was actually telling people it was doing something else.
Yeah.
Something useful, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it sounds like, Ben, you could really make some money if people are spending money on
if I was malicious.
OkCupid.
Here's the worst part. Worse than that is if I gave this to somebody and they decided to be malicious, they could obviously get all of people's information on OkCupid. They could also request additional permissions. And if they do that, probably 50% of the users are going to just ignore it and not do anything, and then they won't have the plugin anymore. Some people are going to be like, you know, why does it need that? I don't trust this developer anymore. But a lot of people are going to be like, oh yeah, a dialog box, hit OK, right?
Right. And
those people now,
what kind of permissions that could it get? Location information,
a ton of stuff.
Be able to edit every web page.
Yeah, being able to edit any and all web pages, not just read, but also change things.
So you're stuck in a situation where you don't want to develop this project anymore. 12,000 people are finding it useful.
I just can't give it over to someone, though.
So what's your option? You got to turn it off, right?
That's the tricky thing, is that every once in a while, so just a day ago or 2 days ago, I got an email. A GitHub issue was filed against the project. The Chrome extension is no longer working. Why? I have no idea. It could be a 5-minute fix. It could be a 20-minute fix. It could be a 5-day fix, right?
It could be something you couldn't fix.
It could be something that's unfixable if they decided to implement some smarter rate limiting. So now I'm in this position of like, okay, there's this thing that I've supported for years. This is thing that more people are using than I've ever counted. I've never counted up to 12,000. That's a lot of people, right?
More people using the extension than listen to GeekSpeak.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's
true. Okay, so...
Well, if you count, but it's close, but yeah.
So I guess before I was working at Facebook, this would be my highest impact thing,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
Now it's not. It's definitely not. But it's...
Now you file bugs that fix things better than that.
it's just tricky, you know? And so...
So what are you going to do?
If
you have a recommendation on what Ben should do, please email us.
Oh, yeah, please.
Geeks@geekspeak.org.
I mean, gladly.
It would be cool if you could find someone you trust.
Yeah, Lyle, you've got time, right?
I don't.
Okay, so I did.
I'm thinking our intern might be interested, sir.
Here's some things I have done. On the GitHub page, which of course some very small percentage of the users know to go to the GitHub page, but on the GitHub page, I put a note, this plugin is no longer in active development due to lack of free time, blah, blah, blah. And I wrote the following. This is kind of my plan of action currently. If you're interested in forking and continuing development on this plugin, please do. I'm open to directing users of this plugin to another plugin if the feature set is similar enough and it's under more active development than this one. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to just take all 12,000 people and port them over or transfer the project from one username to another, but I might pop up a dialogue and say, hey, this is a deprecated plugin. I'm no longer supporting it. If you're finding it useful, take a look at this other plugin. I can't advocate for it 100%, but it seems good. And then the users can make their own choice. And then, you know, if there's blood, it's not on my hands. I don't know. It's tricky. It's so tricky because
there's 20 people who have forked it. Nobody's ever done a pull request for you. You're the only developer on it.
Is that true?
I think so.
I thought someone had done a pull request.
Oh, maybe.
There are 5 pull requests.
Oh, okay. That's not bad.
And 17 closed. Bam. Disproven.
But are these other people?
Yeah. Yeah, they're all other people.
See, you've been getting help on it.
It's just so tricky because...
Oh, yeah, the 10 contributors, dude.
Yeah.
That's great. Just contact one of them.
So I already have.
Uh-huh.
But when people make pull requests, I still need to test the pull request. I still need to merge it. I still need to deal with potential merge conflicts. I still need to read. I need to deploy it. I need to like.
It's been a big project. You've made 359 commits. The second person, Evan Carroll, has made 41 commits.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's sizable.
Deleted a lot more than they've added. That's interesting.
I have.
No. No. Evan Carroll deleted a lot more than that.
Yeah. That guy.
Oh no. Comparable. But yeah. Yeah.
That guy's great. It's nice. He's actually cleaning up some of my code. I started this as a personal project.
Yeah.
I didn't start this intending it to be what it became. And so, yeah.
Well, I think that's the dilemma of open source.
It really is.
If you want to give some opinions what to do, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
Especially if you have something I haven't thought of. My gosh.
Hey, we're going to talk about Google joining something of Facebook's, some cell phone jamming. And looking at people and seeing if you can detect people's uniqueness online. We'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio, KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Mr. Ben Jaffe. If you'd like to participate in the show, you can reach us via Twitter and Facebook. We're KUSP Geeks, all one word. And of course, if you've got questions and comments through other means, you can just email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. Okay. I've lost our location. There we go. Open compute.
Open Ben. Commute. We're going to talk about commuting soon.
No, we're not.
Yeah, we are.
Oh, we are? Okay.
Yeah.
So, Ben, open compute, which I didn't know a lot about, is an initiative that's been going on for 8 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's started by Facebook, and the general practice of it is Facebook has lots of data centers, as do a lot of large companies. And these data centers require hardware to be configured in certain ways and designed in certain ways. And in general, the complexity of actually, and I'm talking about the hardware,
mm-hmm.
Is such that when you invest a lot of time in it, if you can get other people to use your same platform and they invest time in it, then you'll get people producing hardware that will be cheaper for everybody involved.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like a savings in sharing.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's another kind of open source project, right? And of course, open source projects require time and effort to do, which we were talking about in the last section.
Sure.
But they also can bring real benefit, especially when you're talking about hardware. And if a lot of people all use the same brand of hard drive, for example, then obviously there's going to be more demand, and then the price will come down.
Yeah, absolutely. So recently, Google decided to join the Facebook forward. I shouldn't say it's Facebook initiative. They definitely started it, but it's actually Open Open Connect is a very large, used by many people.
Open Compute, excuse me,
at this point. And Google is joining in, and what they're bringing to the table is some experience with a different type of voltage use. And basically, Google, of course, runs a lot of data centers.
Oh, yeah.
And there's been stories over the years of some private and secrecy, but also some shared information. So sometimes there'll be videos of people going through their data centers. They did things like traditionally, every computer has a power supply that plugs into 110 volts, which is our wall current. And then from there, you would get a transformation that would give you different voltages in the computer, 12 volt being the main bus voltage and then other voltage as well. So that transformation of the 110 to 12 volt is actually a loss. Every time you transfer electricity to two different forms, you lose some, there's some
mm-hmm.
waste.
Mm-hmm.
And so Google had moved to the situation where they're using large 12-volt batteries, like car batteries in big arrays, I believe, that were holding the voltage stable, and then they'd have something that was charging that, and all the systems were running off that. So the actual power buses in the data centers were 12 volts, and that was years ago, and they gained a lot of power savings, by moving to that kind of system. Well, in this new system that they're recommending, they say that they're gaining another 30% over the older design by going to a 48 voltage, I'm assuming DC, line. So 30% more saving, more efficient than the 12-volt architecture that is currently mostly being used. Pretty cool.
Like, and they just open sourced this.
They just said, hey, yeah, let's let everybody do this. And they took and I love some of the quotes. They're like, so they did advocacy. Let me see if I can find this great little quote.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I've lost it. We believe this will help everyone adopt this next generation power architecture and realize the same power efficiency and cost benefits as Google. And I can't find the exact quote, but it's basically, we've been doing this a long time. It's worked for us. Here you go. And there's something wonderful. If Google says, in our data centers, we've been doing this for years, now you can do it too, you go, thank you very much.
Yeah,
like, you know they did a good job, right?
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's not just some garbage. It's like the pioneers
yeah.
of a lot of this technology, Facebook, Google, releasing this stuff for free. That's just, that's amazing. It's incredible.
Cool. And the project OpenCompute.org project has all the documentation stuff if you're curious about this. Unless you run a data center, it's not going to be that interesting. I mean, it's not going to be that useful directly
for you. I was just about to open a data center.
That's something you'll do in your spare time, right?
Yeah, right, right.
It's very cool that there's some collaboration in that space, though, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
It makes a lot of sense to do open source with software, and it's easy to do.
Yeah. And you can fork it and change it, and it makes a lot of sense, yeah.
But I'm so happy that this is happening with hardware, too.
Yeah.
Like, with things that are outside. Because software just is so well-suited, right?
Hardware is difficult, too. I mean, if we look at the connectors we're using right now, we're using these connectors called XLR connectors.
That's for our microphones.
Yeah, these things have been around forever. Mm-hmm. Are they open source? No, they're not open source. They're a standard. Anybody can make them. There might be some patents on them. But they also do those things, is once they exist, they kind of stick around forever.
We're using a lot of different connectors.
We're using
USB type A. We're using micro USB. That's plugging in the recorder into your computer. We're using, a 3.5 millimeter TRS. That's also known as your headphone jack. And these are all things that
have been around a long time.
They've been around a long time. Yeah.
All right. Commuting? You have a story about commuting?
I do have a story about commuting and cell phone jamming, actually. And this is just a brief story, but I think it's kind of an interesting jumping off point for a brief conversation. This story is about how this man named Dennis Nicole has been accused of using a cell phone jamming device to interfere with cell phone calls on a red line train in Chicago. And so the idea is, you're hanging out in the subway, you're going home from a long day at work, you hear all these people yammering away around you, and you just think, God, I wish they'd stop, right?
And if you're a hacker...
if you're a hacker, or if you know where to get these devices, China, you can buy these cell phone jamming devices and just, you know, reach into your bag and turn on your cell phone jamming device, and all of the calls get dropped because it's jamming. At first,
it gets louder. Hey, hello? Hello?
Hello?
And then they all stop working.
And so he recently got, in trouble for that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it just kind of raises an interesting question for me. Like, if you're talking loudly on a cell phone in a subway car, or if you're playing music loudly, you're impacting other people around you. You're annoying other people around you. So, like, kind of on a more ethical or moral perspective, is it moral? Is it okay to stop that practice?
Well,
I mean, downside is you're stopping people who are talking very quietly as well.
But you're also stopping people from texting people, which shouldn't be affecting you much at all.
That's a good point.
Or listening to a streaming service via headphones, you know, streaming music service.
Really, Spotify or something.
Or even Netflix.
Or Netflix. Who so watches Netflix in the subway?
A lot of people.
Probably,
you'd be surprised. It's definitely, I think, too big a hammer for that kind of problem.
Yeah,
but there is a social convention that should be addressed. Like, if that's the concern the person has, I totally understand that. I think that some train systems that are longer commutes have respect quiet cars versus noisy cars.
That's true.
It's probably a better way to handle it.
But what's the enforcement on that?
There actually are cars that are supposed to be quiet. They're supposed to be. Yeah, yeah.
But it's enforced.
Yeah, there are systems, at least in Europe, that are enforced.
Oh, really?
In that way, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
To be quiet in certain areas.
I should move to Europe.
Yeah, maybe. The other thing, though, is you can make a lot of noise without a cell phone. You know, you can just talk to somebody loudly if you're communicating with somebody else.
You know what? These are all really good points. I mean, yeah, it's the wrong tool for the job. It's the wrong hammer. And it's interfering with, you know, broadcasts. Yada yada. There are regulations that are very, very clear and have penalties that are this is not okay, right?
Yeah, definitely. The FCC frowns upon broadcasting or breaking broadcast, like doing interference with regulated frequencies.
Yeah.
Is a federal offense.
Yeah, definitely.
Can I say that earlier you forward promoted a story that is now time to cover?
Oh,
you talked about Pi Day.
You
talked about 3.14, and I said it was Pi Day. We're recording on Pi Day. We actually broadcast later in the week. Pi Day, of course, is March 14th, as it is every year, because Pi starts with 3.14, March 14th.
You know what? Last year was better.
Because?
3, March, 0.14, 14th, 1, 5,
which is the 2015. The year last year. Yeah, sure.
And so actually someone, and, I saw an article that was like—
during the time of day was also something, yeah, you could get really
close. 1.5, yeah, 9.2. So I saw an article this year. So last year was crazy. That was awesome. I forgot to get a pie. This year I saw an article that said, happy rounded pie day. Because 0.14159, 159 rounds up to 1.6. It's 2016. Yeah, it's a stretch.
What I saw, and I put this on Twitter today because I'd never seen it before, if you take 3.14 and you write it such that the 3 is a rounded shape, mm-hmm. right? And the 4 is a 4 where the horizontal line bisects the vertical line. So it's kind of a— you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Plus, a plus symbol with one angle. That's a one way to write a 4. Not the split top opening like a football game, but instead a triangle.
Right.
Fun doing this in radio, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you take that, imagine that 3.14 in that shape. Now flip it in the XY axis. So it's flipped so that instead of 3.14, it's the 4 first going backwards.
Okay. But the numbers are flipped too.
Numbers are flipped too. Can you read that in English? What does a backwards 4 look like?
Kind of like an A?
No,
not really. It's like a— I'm having trouble with
it. I know it's hard to do that.
I'm good with spatial reasoning, but I'm having trouble.
A four flipped that way looks like a P.
Oh.
And a 1 looks like a
I.
And a 3 looks like a
E.
So pi backwards spells pi. I know. Blew me away.
Wow. So it's like alphanumeric palindrome-ish.
It's highly geeky. Okay. You know Raspberry Pi, it's a very small computer, it's an open source platform actually.
Oh yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So the Raspberry Pi, it's like a teeny, teeny little computer. Yeah,
yep.
And it's got a couple ports.
And it's been getting more and more powerful, and it's cheap.
And it looks like a circuit board. It doesn't look like a laptop or a desktop or anything, or a Mac Mini. It looks like a circuit board that someone ripped out of something and put on your desk.
And you can plug in a USB into a wall board and you get a full computer and it's got Wi-Fi and it's a really amazing little device.
Yeah.
And it costs like under $50. Yeah, it runs Linux. Runs PiX. I don't know what it's called, but it's something with pi in it. They always use the term pi in it. In any case, for Pi Day, they released a hard drive.
Okay.
It's relatively large.
Why did they release a hard drive for Pi Day?
Because they always—
I mean, hard drives are round like pies.
Yeah, but— no, but so the hard drive has a certain size, and the size is 314 gigabytes.
No.
Yeah, pretty nerdy. And also—
that's
for that,
awesome.
For that one day, the normal price is something higher, but for the one day of Pi Day, which has already passed by the time you've heard this, unfortunately, is it costs $31.42.
$3.14. Whoa.
Yeah, pretty cool.
That's
so
pretty
a
cool.
Hard drive. Okay, imagine that.
They're geeks.
It's really small, and it works for— of course, you can plug into a Raspberry Pi,
mm-hmm.
and the normal price is not that much more than that.
How do you partition a hard drive to be 314 gigabytes? Like,
I know.
They probably are sourcing a 512 gigabyte drive.
Well,
and
the thing is, I don't know how hard drives work at that level. You can definitely get 350 gig hard drives. It's very common that this is like a derivative that's— the size is, you know, specific.
Yeah.
But at the same time, drives are tested for reliability, and depending on how many sectors are valid, that's how much they say is valid. So you could theoretically have a really large hard drive that had some errors in it.
So a really, really bad large hard drive.
Yeah, it's possible it's that.
Poorly
this is
manufactured.
By Western Digital. I'm assuming it's not. They probably just manufactured that one was close. And you're right, it's probably more like 350 or something that was a standard thing that they were targeting. Anyway, that's kind of fun.
Well, that's really cool. That's awesome. I wonder if they just happened to have a lot of 350 gig hard drives laying around in a warehouse and they thought, hey.
Yeah, it's cool. And you got another story?
Oh, yeah, I do. This is about detecting people.
This is a pretty complicated one, isn't it?
Right. So, and I'll try and kind of simplify it by glossing over a couple of the details. This is this thing called Tor. And it's a thing that you can browse using Tor to make yourself anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that if I'm browsing, let's say, geekspeak.org through the Tor network, because of the way it works and the way that my signal gets routed through these other pieces in the system, which are actually other people, when you see my traffic, you can't identify it as me by looking at where it came from.
Normally, we have IP addresses. Everybody has an IP address. And normally, if Ben connected me directly, the IP address that I would see would be basically your home IP address. It would be very easy to know who you were.
Yeah, it'd be some four numbers separated by dots.
So the Tor is a whole structure, giant structure, open source actually, that's intended to make that impossible.
Right. So the whole point of using Tor is to not be able to be identified, to not be able to be tracked, to be anonymous, right? So this is really great for people with sensitive information, whistleblowers, those kinds of things. Also, very paranoid people can use this. and it's actually not very hard to set up. This is an article about how Tor users can be tracked based on other methods, especially specifically their mouse movements. So we've covered we've covered in the past how different users have a different people have different cadences when they type.
Sure.
They also have different cadences when they move the mouse around,
or when they speak, or when they walk.
Yeah, exactly. These
people
are all just things.
People are unique flowers.
These are outputs, and embedded in our output is this fingerprint of us. Mm-hmm. And so you and I, if we type the same thing on the keyboard, you're consistently going to type it a certain way, and I'm going to consistently type it with a different cadence.
And detecting the difference between you and me typing would be extremely easy.
Yeah, exactly. Assuming you have a really good clock, right? So
you mean a clock to time those little tiny inconsistencies.
Exactly.
Like when the mouse moves left versus right or whatever the pattern is, you have to know really granularity how it works. Yeah.
So this is a story just about how you can fingerprint users based on that stuff. And actually, this is something that people on the Tor project have already started thinking about. In fact, there's an issue that's been open for 10 months on the project, issue 16110.
Open source, baby.
Yeah, 16110. That's a lot of issues before that one.
How is this fix it?
Improved time resolution defense. So basically, make the timer... make the ability to time things like keystrokes or mouse movements
inconsistent.
Kind of fudge it. It to the left or to the right. You know, make it so it's mostly the same, but each of those timing moments is actually shifted a little bit forward or backward. So you're randomizing the typing cadence or the mouse movement cadence.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, so hopefully that will be implemented.
Another way to do this would be to like start using your left hand.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
I mean, you could best it up once, but then they get a signature for that too. All right, anyway. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geeks said hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out more about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak, just visit us online at geekspeak.org. Thanks to our intern Chandler, our support geek Greg Merkley, and to Michael Newman of Petstar Music for our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 11 of our 16th season. Ben, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Lyle.
In the post show, was there anything else you wanted to cover?
Six micro robots pull a car. That's
how big is a micro robot?
They like total a couple grams. Hold on, I've got.
How'd they pull a car?
I've got a number for you. Six tiny robotic ants is what it calls them. They weigh 3.5 ounces.
They are small.
In total.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. They're like half. They're like a little bit
Ben,
north
was
of half an ounce.
Was this a Lego car? Like a full-size car?
No. No, this is so this is some graduate students put together this research paper that's awesome. Talking about it. And the whole idea is we can consider building, obviously, things to do certain tasks, but we can also consider building multiple things, like multiple mm-hmm. smaller robots, maybe that can travel more easily or and whatever. And then they can kind of work together, right?
A great metaphor in nature is ants.
Yeah.
Right? A colony of ants can do an amazing amount of stuff,
yeah.
even though each one is very small.
Absolutely. Or if you want to, you know, have a horse pull something or do some kind of work, you can instead just fly six humans on a Southwest flight over and they can do the same work. You know, I mean, horses are a little more difficult to move. So that's one of the stories.
I was thinking you're going with horse pulling something versus dogs, like a whole bunch of dogs versus one horse.
Yeah, we could do that.
That works. Okay.
I guess it's still difficult to
So anyway,
transport
they got these ants to work collaboratively and they actually were able to pull a car.
These micro robot quote ants.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. You want more?
No, yeah. Well, I'm interested about interested in the crossword plagiarism story.
Yeah.
I mean, what I thought of was what's the game that's like crosswords? You build
Scrabble.
Scrabble. And so I thought you were going to tell me a Scrabble plagiarism, but all that Scrabble is plagiarism. That's the whole point. You have to use words that are other people's.
That's true. But all the board configurations you end up with are quite unique.
I would agree. Probably.
Yeah, yeah. So, turns out that a number of crossword puzzle geeks using software have figured out that there's a huge pattern of copying in the professional crossword puzzle world. So there's accusations of plagiarism and there's accusations of false identity.
Are these in the clues or are these in the structure of the? Because I would say that
both.
I would say the clues would be plagiarism. The structure might be copy infringement, but not necessarily plagiarism.
Oh, I have no idea about
like
that.
If I copy a painting of yours, that's not plagiarism. Plagiarism specifically is copying someone else's work and claiming it as your own.
Yeah.
Interesting.
If you copied a painting of mine, well, you chose the wrong person to copy a painting.
Maybe it's somebody else's painting that you own.
I just have to say, while we're on the air, you're a fantastic artist. I, however, am not. I do occasionally try, maybe once every 3 years.
Okay, so they looked at software, found out that, sure enough, if you look at a lot of crossword puzzles, a lot of them are copying each other.
They looked at two crossword series edited by Parker, the USA Today crossword and the Syndicated Universal crossword. And, there's apparently a whole bunch of...
Dupes.
Dupes.
Cheaters.
Since the publication of that article, Universal, Uclick, and USA Today have each said that Timothy Parker will be stepping back from his role creating puzzles from the two publishers while an investigation is conducted. That
I can ask you something, Ben.
Yeah.
Are you good at crossword puzzles?
With the help of computers. Yeah, I'm great at them.
Without the help of computers.
Oh, I just Google.
Okay, so basically you're not one of those people that are really good at crossword puzzles.
I'm not.
Always intrigued by that. Because you are a very smart man. I mean, I know you and having deep intellectual conversation with you, figuring out software problems. You have a great, intelligent, impressive mind.
Mm-hmm.
Not crossword puzzles.
No.
I also can't do crossword puzzles.
But it's a different kind. It's pattern matching.
Is it?
I think it is.
It's linguistic pattern matching. I'm more a visual person than a linguist.
It's pattern matching and it's memory.
I think it's fascinating that there's different types of intelligence, people that can do crosswords and not. I think that's the only type, by the way. There's only people that can do crossword puzzles and people that can't. I mean, another.
I have a horrible memory.
What?
I have a horrible memory.
What were you saying?
I have a horrible memory. I guess I had a good one in that sense. If it was actually, I have to say one thing, if it was a Star Trek crossword puzzle, to bring this all the way back to the beginning of the show.
Beautiful.
If it was a Star Trek crossword puzzle, I would nail it.
You have that universe down.
So great. Oh, yeah. Top speed of the Enterprise.
Ben and I just talked for a long time. We talked a lot about Star Trek, talked a lot about working at Facebook and Netflix and kind of the dynamic of being in the Silicon Valley.
Artificial intelligence, machine learning stuff.
So if you want to listen to a blabbering rant of that stuff without a lot of factual information, just me and Ben chatting, keep listening. If not, see you next week.
I would nail it.
You have that universe
down.
I'd do
so great. Oh, yeah. Top speed of the Enterprise.
What's the Grand Magus of the Ferengi?
That's the Grand Magus, yeah. Grand Magus Zek.
I was trying to get a clue and I gave you the answer.
Give me another one.
How many wives does the Grand Magus have?
First off,
you can give me any answer you want because I do not know.
Wives? No, I don't.
Ferengi have gender, right?
Yeah, they do.
But
they
mostly meet men.
Yeah, yeah. In their culture, women are not allowed to own property, wear clothes, any of that stuff. And
they are such a despicable race.
It's true. They're despicable.
Do you find anything redeeming about them, the Ferengi race?
There is a heavy parallel in Star Trek Deep Space Nine drawn between the Ferengi and our capitalist society. And it's a great reflection. It's really interesting because the things that we find despicable are painted in such a way that we can see how they're just an extrapolation from where we already are.
Give an example. So the Ferengi race is all about money. Everything's important about money. Like not having money means you're not worthy. Your soul is dedicated to money.
Heaven is the divine treasury.
Yeah.
And hell is the vault of eternal destitution.
Right.
Yeah. So everything is centered around profit.
By the way, if you've seen Deep Space Nine, or even they showed up in Star Trek as an extra as well, they have these very large ears
that
into an eyebrow.
And their heads kind of look like butts.
And they have little tiny teeth, pointy teeth.
Yeah, pointy teeth.
And they're always looking for the edge.
The edge, yeah, that's true.
They're capitalistic in to the extreme. So you're saying that that's the thing that sci-fi or speculative fiction in general does a great job of, is it takes and creates a parallel for you so that you can understand your own world better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, there's also the whole Cardassian occupation of Bajor. There are two races on Star Trek. One's Cardassians, one's the Bajorans. And the Cardassians had basically violently occupied the Bajoran planet for a long time. And
Bajorans also have complicated ears, but a little sexier.
No, they wear
jewelry.
They do not have complicated ears. They have earrings and they have ridged noses.
Ridged noses, that's right. Yeah. Well, I always notice the ears because they always got the jewelry on the ear.
Only one, though.
And the Cardassians have, like, they're kind of reptilian looking, and they've got necks that have kind of veininess in them, and they have really broad shoulders and kind of flat.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. And they tortured Picard.
So the thing that I love about that is that when you first start watching that series, the Cardassians are very, very, very clearly the bad guys.
Oh, yeah.
You can compare them with... Germany. You can make all of these comparisons, and they all hold up. But the strange thing is, by the end of the series, you kind of come to understand it a little bit more. Not necessarily like it's not okay, but you understand how their society, with their norms and their values, could do something like that and feel fine with it. And in a way,
if you explore that entire experience, what you're left with is what?
It exposes the complex pieces of humanity as well. Uh-huh. It makes us look at ourselves with the same scrutiny as we look at the bad guys, who actually kind of have a point in some ways, despite the fact that what they're doing is awful.
So the reason I never got into Deep Space Nine is
because you never watched past season 3. Well, Earlier episodes are rough.
I'm sure I've seen episodes of that, but keep in mind the time when that came out is like when I entered college and had like a busy life and, you know, had a girlfriend, all that stuff. But
why,
Star Trek in general, I was watching Babylon 5, which I actually liked quite a bit. It has a kind of darker side than Star Trek universe.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more gritty. There are bad guys and good guys that fight each other and kill each other. Star Trek, you know, if you look at what Roddenberry designed in the original series and also in Next Generation, you have a futuristic society where pretty much every general need is taken care of by the population. People are taken care of. No one's destitute in the human race necessarily.
There's no internal conflict
either. There's no internal conflict in the human race.
Yeah.
Or at least not shown. And the general idea of this is that the human race has gotten to a plateau where they treat each other really well.
Yeah,
and
we're mature. We have eliminated hunger and poverty. We all work together collaboratively.
Yeah, and the goal is really just to do better in yourself and do better as a society and explore the universe. And that, to me, is this really kind of course, it's simplistic, right? I mean, humans are much more complicated than that and all that. But I think that idea of a future society where we're like that is something that's very beautiful. Deep Space Nine went actually not really like that at all, and was what was hard for me to consume.
It's a little more complicated. There's a subtlety there. So the Next Generation happened on the flagship of the Federation, the Enterprise.
Right.
This is like
everybody's top notch.
This is like the Facebook of Silicon Valley startups or the Netflix of like. All of the things that you could need are provided. There's no internal conflict, or when there is, it's well managed, et cetera, blah, blah, blah.
That's what my wife says when I'm going to work. She's like, oh, you're going to the Star Trek Enterprise. Right?
Actually, I put a calendar event on my calendar to remind me after I'd been working at Facebook for maybe 2 weeks. And the calendar event said, reminder, you are on the Enterprise.
to be clear, people that don't understand what this is like, it sounds like bragging, but it is an interesting perspective in our society, and that is that Ben and I work for companies that take care of their employees in this really strange way.
Yeah.
We have all our needs taken care of. We're paid pretty well. And in general, we don't have wants around the office, right?
Right.
You've seen this and stuff. You've seen the show Silicon Valley, or in general seen, you know, oh, Google people get free lunch. Yeah, Ben and I both get free lunch, right?
Right.
This general idea that the idea is that our time and energy is worth more than the amount of money they might pay us for a lunch. And so they just cover everything so that while we're there, all we're thinking about is the work. And it works really well.
All right. So Facebook has problems.
Sure.
And Netflix has problems. But most of the problems are outside. they're the problems that are not under control of the people running Facebook or running Netflix, right? Same with the enterprise. So all of the conflict that you see in Star Trek The Next Generation is outside of the ship. It's some bad alien race who's doing something bad, or some bad person who's trying to, you know, pull one over on a whole population, or right. yada, 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 right? All of the conflict comes from outside, and it's the refined and mature human race, the United Federation of Planets, who's kind of going around the galaxy and spreading democracy, right? It's really
so ridiculous,
right? So yeah. In a way that's kind of unrealistic, but it offers a good grounded center for exploring conflict in a way where your
you
heroes
simplify it.
Yeah where your heroes are still heroes.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine is not the flagship of the Federation. It's the abandoned outpost that no one cares about. Everything's broken. It wasn't even built by the Federation. It was taken over. Everything's just, it's really, really bad. Everything's broken. And the conflict doesn't come from externally, right? You don't have to explore the galaxy to find conflict. They instead look inwards and they find it in themselves. The space station, one more thing, the space station itself is a melting pot of different societies, different races, and they all have to try and find a way to work together. They can't escape each other.
Right.
And that feels more realistic to me, why I like it.
I get that, and I do agree with you. As much as you can say it's realistic to talk about a space station with alien races, I think that it has a more truthness to the way intelligent beings interact with each other. But there's a lot, and the reason I brought up Babylon 5 is that also has a grittiness about different races interact with each other and all of that.
Right.
But the universe of Star Trek was set up by Roddenberry to be a certain way, and Deep Space Nine changed that. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's probably interesting and rich. He also didn't have a hand in it, right?
It's worth noting that, he died, I think, before it went on the air.
Right.
I think that's right.
But his wife was involved quite a bit.
Definitely. She actually played...
I'm blanking on her name. She's been in every
show. Oh, Major Barrett Roddenberry.
Yeah.
You just asked me, man.
Thank you. I knew you knew.
She played the voice of the computer on the Enterprise. She also played...
On both Enterprises, right? She was actually... she was Deanna's mother.
Lexana Troi.
Lexana Troi. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In both The Next Generation and...
I have some Star Trek cred.
Oh, like, yeah.
I
totally. Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
I kind of compete with you, but... you know, we've done this Geek Speak episode until it got dry. And I mean, it's interesting to us, but I think we should probably wrap it up, don't we?
That's true. I do have to say one thing.
Okay.
It feels so good to talk about Star Trek without guilt. Because we basically said, if you don't like Star Trek,
get out of here.
Right. Like, you
should
stop.
Maybe we should re-record that and put it at the very beginning, too. So people really know.
Maybe. I don't know.
At this point forward, we're only talking about Star Trek. If you don't want to hear about Star Trek, don't listen to the show. There. Now your guilt all completely gone.
Yeah.
I'll put that in the beginning. So wait. Let's go back to this thing, though, the idea that, because it sounds a little bit cultish to me.
What does?
The idea that we're, that, you know, you say there's problems with Facebook, there's problems with Netflix, all these companies have problems, obviously, but there's not problems internally. Of course there are. Not exactly.
But, yeah, that's not what I meant. But what I'm saying is, like, the big problems that are of... Like, if you were to go to Facebook or you were to go to Netflix or something, probably the interesting problems wouldn't be inter-office dynamics. It would be like, how does Netflix struggle with net neutrality? Or how does Facebook struggle with net neutrality? That's the kind of dramatic stuff, right? That's
the
stuff you'd make a television show about.
Yeah, true. I see what you're saying. So you're saying that it's much more like the Next Generation kind of enterprise thing rather than Deep Space Nine thing.
Right. As opposed to scrappy startup, that... All of the trouble is, how the heck do we get this working? Like, Bob is not a great IT guy after all. You know, like, it's the office.
I think if you have a relatively functional... I mean, do you think that was true at your last startup job that you had?
That it was
a lot of inter-problems, like it was more Deep Space 90 than Next Generation? I think that most of the time, Silicon Valley's companies, as soon as they get some kind of capability, become a, let's all get together, work really hard, and figure out the outside influence problems.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But I joined, my last company was at maybe 120 people or something.
Okay. Like so it's already big.
It was a good number of people, yeah. So they were past that stage already.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely... I mean, I've been a front-end developer for startups before that were like five people.
Right.
And yeah, man, there's a lot of drama.
I've done a lot of mom-and-pop shops. There were a lot of stress inside.
I'm so happy I'm not doing that
and
anymore.
A lot of drama. You know, I was at UCSC for years. There's a lot of interpersonal drama. Not as much like outwardly, but there is definitely a bit of politicalness that you have to deal with. Much less so at this company. I'm assuming also is Facebook. Mm-hmm. You know, let me ask you something about I mean, the reason for this, of course, is that the reason why Facebook and Google and Netflix and all these companies can be so great to their employees and have no cares and have high salaries is because they're making a lot of money and they're really successful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of them, but there's enough of them where it's a culture thing, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I know people that have moved from Netflix to Facebook and back and to Google and to Apple. The developers that
all those companies have thousands of people.
And they move around a bit. You know, we know people from different companies. So there's a culture of these kind of developer, you know, UI engineer being taken care of and all the needs and being paid well. And I'm just curious if that is that, what does that do to, I mean, it's almost an elite position.
Yeah.
It makes me a little uncomfortable. I don't like the idea of being an elite.
You know,
I was born poor and always struggling artist kind of person. And so to see myself in this new type of position and see that everybody I know around the work is the same way, and you know, it's there's something a little strange about it.
It is very strange. It is very strange. And I don't know. I mean, at the risk of being redundant, it makes me think of the enterprise.
Yeah.
Like that's actually the reason if I didn't like one thing about the next generation, it would be that. It would be that the internal dynamics seem too perfect. It doesn't feel quite realistic.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to work,
Does it feel that way?
A little bit, but only because of the privilege side of it, right?
Yeah.
It's nothing that Facebook or Netflix or any of these companies are doing.
It's the awareness that not everybody's in the same position we are.
Yes, absolutely. And I've as long as I've been privileged, I mean, I'm a white male, right? So,
right. Yeah.
So there's that, right? I've always tried to be as aware of that as possible. But yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah.
And actually,
in a traditional business, the reason why an oil company, for example, would make would have that amount of money and that kind of ability for these elite people is because they're taking resources from the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like the general flow is that they've capitalized on something that's actually a limited resource and they own it. Land owners in general are an example of that. They have our limited resources, other people want it, and therefore they make money off of it.
Yeah, like if you're pumping oil from the ground, you're not paying for that oil. You're paying for the energy to claim it.
Right.
But
and you're paying for legal protect and all that stuff.
Yeah,
but in
just,
reality, you're taking a resource that just
you're just
exists.
Taking it, yeah.
And a lot of businesses like that. Media is different than that normally, right? Like a writer, they're actually creating something and then putting it out there. Like, you know, creative intent is kind of like that. We do more like that than traditional, forestry or something like that where there's a resource being used.
Yeah.
There's a creative process.
That's a good point.
I'm trying to find like where it feels okay and where it doesn't feel okay.
Well, let's explore that a little bit. If you're a writer, let's say you're a documentary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
You're not taking a resource, no. But the only reason you exist is because you're exploiting the resource of someone else's interesting story.
Yep.
So you're taking their story and you're telling it. Maybe you pay them, maybe you don't.
Documentaries rarely pay the subject matter. Yeah.
Right, right. If you're a writer and you're writing pure fiction, I suppose in a sense you're capitalizing on the people who have influenced you, but that's a real stretch. It's really mostly from your imagination and it's not compromising anyone.
I mean, the way that Netflix makes money is that we buy the rights to different types of shows, and then we're the only provider of that show in legal form in your area. And then to watch that show, you pay us, and then we give that show to you. So that's capitalizing other people's creativity.
Yeah.
What's Facebook's?
I mean, Facebook's is monetizing through advertisement, right? So, Facebook knows things about who you are because you interact with the platform, and they can match you up with ads that are best suited for you.
And right? Those ads are worth more for the advertiser because they're going to the right person. Like,
right. It's targeted advertisement as opposed to just, you know, blasting everybody in the United States with the same Super Bowl ad. I mean, I don't know. I don't have a kid. I don't need a baby product, but I may have seen the ad.
I know. If you don't feel comfortable answering this, please don't feel free not to. I'll definitely say no on some questions. But do you do things like, does the system do things like someone just looked up, like just befriended a hair salon place? Do they then get advertised hats because they might have gotten a bad haircut? I mean, is there that kind of complexity in the system?
Or like, are you thinking about getting a haircut?
I definitely need a haircut. Look at me. I look like a mop.
You do look like a mop. Yeah. No, you look like you look a little like Animal. Yeah. Animal, big drums, bang bang.
Yeah, I haven't cut any hair on my body for way too long. So,
I don't know how you deal with a mustache.
Oh man, it's hard.
It gets in your face, in your mouth.
No, the length at this point now is such that if I do not wax it, I will bite it when I'm eating. It's a horrible sensation.
Really?
Oh, it's really bad.
Then,
I wax it all the time.
Wow.
Yeah, you like put soft wax in it and then push it off to the sides. I mean, it looks cool, right?
Yeah, it looks cool, except that...
That was I was pulling for that one.
No, I've had a mustache before that's
You have
not,
a mustache now.
Never that long, though. No. But like, if I tried to bite my mustache, I couldn't.
Oh, well, I can do the whole curly Q thing, dude.
Oh, that looks good. This is great for a radio show.
A little evil look. Doesn't that look great?
You do look a little
I'll
evil,
put a picture up. There's lots of pictures of it.
Are
we wrapping it up?
Yeah, we're wrapping it up. I don't know about the Facebook ads question because I don't work on that team.
Right. I was kind of joking because I'm always thinking like targeted ads, like what level of complexity? Because if you've had a bad haircut, you want a hat, right? So if you like a page or visit a page that's a hair place and the numbers are, you know, the ratings are low, maybe it means because you just did like.
I think this should go on your 25-cent ideas page, right?
Okay, so oh, stop.
I'm sorry.
No, but here's the question though. We surface films algorithmically as you guys
right.
surface ads algorithmically.
Right.
And I say we, you know, the company that I work for and you, the company you work for. It's not like you and I do those things.
And neither of us speak for our companies. So
right. And we think about it a lot, but that's about it. But because of that, the algorithms that are used to decide what films to show you are based off of what you've watched. Okay.
Right.
And also what other people have watched. That's the general flow of it. And a lot of this data is actually
and that's,
public.
And that's the incoming data that Netflix gets about its users.
Right.
Right.
And so really smart people look at number crunching. Yeah, sorry.
And I was just going to say, and if you got other signals, you would probably use those too if they were, you know, predictive of the kind of content the user wants to watch.
So the complexity that emerges in that has to do with a whole bunch of engineers that are interested in algorithm production, working on algorithms that then kind of work on each other. There's a little bit of let's tune this algorithm over time based off these other figures. So they become relatively complex. At some point, the idea that because you watch this movie, you might watch this movie, the complexity there might be so great that it's kind of like, hey, this movie has a cat in it and the cat died and it's really sad. This other movie has on the box art, the image you see of the movie, has a picture of a cat that's similar. So people that have watched this sad movie might watch this other movie more. They have no correlation besides some visual and experiential inference.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't program for that. There's been no reason to decide to do that. But because there's a correlation between the two films, that will emerge in the system. And that rule exists because of the experience the person has. But no one knows that's going on. So there's complexities in the system that go beyond what you think will happen when you get complex systems.
Right, absolutely.
Like this.
We talk actually a lot about that on Linear Regressions, which is the other podcast that I do.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about data science and machine learning, and we kind of talk about how some of these algorithms work. Even not at a really deep level, we kind of try to make it accessible to people who don't know machine learning and data science. Like me, I get to learn every week and just ask hopefully good questions. But yeah, it's interesting because we're at the point where humans are not creating the algorithms that do the thing. Humans are creating algorithms that tune algorithms that do the thing.
Right.
Or sometimes even a level deeper than that.
Right.
And that's I think a little bit of where the fear behind, you know, AI taking over the world and all that stuff comes from, is that we're not fully in control.
Let's get back to that in just a second. But the other thing to note is that though that algorithm was created to modify an algorithm, the person that actually wrote the algorithms, the team of five that worked on that 4 years ago,
mm-hmm.
no longer is working on that anymore.
Oh, yeah.
They moved on to something else.
Yeah, there's
so
that.
They kind of exist in their own space, right? Because they keep working. And then the people that worked on them that understood them at some level don't anymore. So there is loss of human ownership of these systems that then move on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they might get modified over time as well. Okay, but the AI thing. Quick question. You're an engineer. Do you think we're going to, in our lifetime, have to be scared of artificial intelligence being controlling of our lives?
Hmm. Well, you're an engineer. I could ask the same question to you.
I think that we will slowly slip into a place that our grandparents would think creepy, that we will think is fine.
You're saying that the goalpost will be moved.
It is constantly moving all the time. The idea that right now when I take a photograph of you, my app says, my phone says to me, want to share these pictures with Ben, is weird.
Right.
Amazing and cool.
It's amazing
but
and cool.
Weird.
Now, in a year, you might be like, oh yeah, I love that feature. It makes my life so much easier.
I would turn
5
that feature
years ago, you'd be like, I'm going to destroy this phone. Like,
well, 20 years ago, I would have been like, there's a demon in my pocket.
Right. But right, yeah.
You know what, though? We have a problem here. We went into Star Trek. We said we're going to only talk about Star Trek.
Oh,
we talked
no.
about other things.
Oh, no, we did. Okay, I think we just need to end the show.
Well, let's do a little recording bit talking about that I can put right at the end of the show that kind of synopsizes the post-show stuff.
Okay. You want to do that?
Ben and I just talked for a long time. We talked a lot about Star Trek, talked a lot about working at Facebook and Netflix and kind of the dynamic of being in the Silicon Valley. Can you
and artificial intelligence, machine learning stuff.
So if you want to listen to a blabbering rant of that stuff without a lot of factual information, just me and Ben chatting, keep listening. If not, see you next week. Good?
Sounds good. That was a good one.
All right. Bye.
Bye.